This is episode 27 of the Great Speech Podcast on How to Win at Work, an expert panel conversation with me, Simon Gray, and Richard Mann.
Let's go.
It's a Great Speech Podcast for the public speakers. We're going way down deep to look at what makes a communicator. We'll look at all different topics from the bottom to the top. So get your mind free of all the distractions and please listen up, listen up, listen up.
It's the Great Speech Podcast.
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 Thanks, Dad. And welcome back to the Great Speech Podcast, my great communicators. How you guys doing? I hope you are well. Welcome back, as I said, to this, actually the final episode of this season of the Great Speech Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this season as much as I have. I really have, actually. I really feel that I am getting into my stride, as it were. So listen, I'm not going to kind of take too much of your time this time. This episode, slightly different one, because I recently held an expert panel. I chaired an expert panel with two brilliant gentlemen on what we call the Win at Work webinar series or summit. It was all about how to become indispensable at work by developing your skills and your abilities so that whenever things have to be considered at work, you are the one that is chosen, whether that's for leadership, for promotion, or in these very difficult times for keeping and saving your job, which is just as important as progressing in other times. And it was a really interesting discussion because these two gentlemen, so Richard Mann is a performance under pressure coach. He's a former SBS soldier and has really taken the skills, the mindset that he learnt through that incredible experience and channeled that into his coaching of people on how to succeed, how to perform at the highest levels, how not to buckle under pressure when things get hard and while everybody around you is buckling and failing. So he really comes to us with a lot of knowledge on how to manage stress and anxiety and perform even when times are hard, you know, kind of going gets tough, tough get going kind of thing. So he was one gentleman on the panel. And the second was someone who you may be familiar with if you've listened to this podcast. That's Simon Gray. And he is an executive job search coach. He really kind of into career development. He wrote the Super Skills book on secrets of finding the right employment and right job for you. And he talks in particular about what he calls the hidden job market, which is actually this fascinating kind of world where there are jobs that just are given and exchanged. And if you don't know about it, you're just locked out of it. But once you do know about it, it's a fascinating way to go about developing your career. So two gentlemen with bounds of knowledge in their field, and me, I of course was talking about communication skills and how that is a crucial element in terms of developing your career. So we had a kind of really wide-ranging discussion on the topic of how do you make yourself indispensable at work and in your career and in business. And it really went and touched on a lot of different subjects. So I really hope you guys enjoy it. It's the last episode of this series. As always, please, please, please do share this podcast with people. In fact, share it now in particular, because it gives people a bit of a chance to catch up with, you know, the 27 episodes that I have done. And do, of course, subscribe if you haven't actually done it yet, so that the minute the new series comes out, you'll be the first to know. I'm fairly certain how I'm going to approach the new series, by the way, as well. I've been inspired by a different podcast that a friend turned me on to, and I think it will work really well for this one. But I'm not going to say it yet until I've fully decided. I will reveal that at the beginning of next season. So without further ado, turn up your ears, tune out the noise, listen and enjoy, because here is me, Richard and Simon, on how to win at work.
Hey, welcome everyone. Thank you. We're going to start bright and on time at 11 o'clock. Welcome to the Win at Work webinar. Really good to have you guys on, actually, because this is one of those topics that we put together, and I'll introduce you to the guys in a second, that we put together just because right now, with all of the kind of economic instability going on with COVID and the lockdown, people being uncertain whether they're going to be back at work or whether they're going to ascend in their career, it really felt like a good time to have a discussion about what does it take to be indispensable at work, right? Or in your career and in your business, what does it take to accelerate it, to make sure that if people are going to be made redundant, it's not you, to make sure if there's a job that you're going to get that's up for grabs, you're the one that gets it, to make sure that your business stands out from all the other businesses out there so that you get the customers, you get the clients. Because really, in a hyper-competitive world as we are now, really, there's probably no more important time to be on top of your game. So that's why we kind of put together this webinar. And I'm really, really pleased to have some great guys, two bald guys as well. We looked at it and decided we're three bald guys.
That's the theme.
We haven't struggled with haircuts in lockdown, have we? We've been fine.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really pleased to have a couple of guys on with me. I'm going to let them introduce themselves and I'll say a little bit about myself. And then we're going to kind of get into the meat of the discussion. So let me take Simon, you first. Why don't you tell us who you are and kind of introduce your focus of work.
Sure. Thanks, Carla. So my name is Simon Gray. I'm an executive career coach. I had a pretty long career in the recruitment industry. And then I left recruitment, left my own business to set up a career consultancy where I work with executives from across the world to help them navigate the job market successfully, to think differently about the market, to think differently about themselves, and to stand out really at every stage of the job search process. I'm the author of a book, a few books actually, but probably the main book in terms of the content for today, Super Secrets of Successful Executive Job Search, which kind of outlines the formula I put together based on my experience in recruitment.
Excellent. Well,
you've got to mention your other book, mate, as well.
Do you know what? That's exactly what I was about to say.
One of the things people have said to me who've been through my executive career coaching program is it's a lot to do with discipline. And that discipline comes from my background in martial arts. So as the guys have said, I've recently published a book called Suck It Up or Go Home about my time training with the Tokyo Riot Police in Japan. So you'll find that on Amazon worldwide. It's a bit blood and guts, but there's a lot of hidden messages in there about discipline, resilience, and some of the stuff we're going to talk about today. Richie, do you want to go next?
Yes, mate. I think it's worth mentioning your book about discipline and resilience. Richard Mann, I'm ex-serving member of Special Forces. For me, that was the Special Boat Service. So I joined the Royal Marines and then the SBS, the Special Boat Service, and that really was a 14-year career in deployments around the world, in pressured environments, high-performance teams in pressured environments. And then I worked in the private security industry for a number of years, looking after high-profile clients, and then really got into the work that I'm doing now, which is performance coaching. And so my focus of work is always about getting our best. How do we get our best? How do we tap into the mind states and the resilience which allows us to be in our best? And that's really where we're looking at in terms of this job market, this uncertainty that Colin mentioned, to stand out in the crowd and to be able to manage some of the stresses and pressures that we feel. So that work at the moment has led me to work with individuals, teams, organizations globally that in performance, in leadership, so they're ultimately being their best.
That's great. I was saying actually, Richard, that although this is about how to win at work, right, how to succeed in the job market, I'm actually going to be listening out for the stuff you say for my daughter, who is going through the 11 plus process at the moment, although we're not entirely sure how it's going to work with kind of things having been shut down. but a lot of the stress factors that I know you talk about, I actually, when I was listening to it, I thought, well, actually, I can see how that will help my daughter. So I'm going to be kind of pushing you on that and keeping kind of
take some notes.
Yeah,
go on, Colin. Exactly. What about yourself? Let's hear from you. Intro yourself.
Yeah. So I am Colin Relishanike. I am a barrister by trade. So I've been a barrister for, 98, so 22 years now, on commercial litigation and employment law, mainly. But I'm also a communications coach, communication skills coach, which is actually really where I'm finding a lot of my passion lies. Because one of the things that I have found, and certainly because my profession as a barrister is all about communication, is that very often people work, when they start their careers, they're all about how can I be good at what I do, right? How can I have the knowledge to achieve, you know, what I need to achieve? How can I have the technical skills to be good at the job or good at the business? And then there kind of comes a point, you know, it can be a couple of years, can be decades, where they realize that actually that is only half of the story. The other half, and probably the more important half, especially if you're looking at becoming leadership, getting into leadership and ascending, is how effectively you can communicate with others. And that really is where the game is played when it comes to accelerating your career, supercharging your career. And so I do a lot of communication skills coaching, where I take people on how to communicate effectively. I'm trying to build a tribe of great communicators. So I coach individuals, directors, companies, all kind of levels on just how do you become more effective at what you say when you say it, whether that's persuasion, negotiations, obviously presentation skills, leadership, storytelling, just a whole range of things. So that's kind of where I am. That's my passion for it. And I've been doing it for good, 15 years now in that area. And just coaching at all different levels. So that's kind of me. And in a way, when I thought about this particular webinar, what I loved is the fact how we are all in different areas that are all entirely relevant to each other and complementary, but all kind of different, distinct topics. So I'm really looking forward to the discussion with you guys. I'm going to be listening personally just to learn, because I kind of think we've all got to be committed to growth at all times. Just before we kind of get into the meat of the discussion, I just wanted to say hi to everyone that has joined as well. We can see your sign up, your kind of registrations and coming in. Really, really great to hear. If you can find a chat box somewhere, sometimes it's a bit difficult to find, depending on what device you're looking at, probably in your right, I imagine, Simon, but you know, that's where it is.
Somewhere on your screen, if you could just we can check that's working, because we want to make this as interactive as possible. So we want to invite your questions, just so I know that it's working. I'm looking to my left, I can see it on the screen. If you just type your name, where you're from, and I can see at least one person pop up, and I know that chat box is working. There's quite a few people on, so let's see who can be the first just to pop something in there, and then I can take a big deep breath and know that the technology is working. So
tech is always gonna be you know, my rule of thumb with people giving presentations, for instance, is assume that the tech will fail and be prepared for when it does.
well the good news is that the tech has worked. Anthony, welcome, thank you for confirming that. So Adriana from the Czech Republic, thank you for being here from Prague. So we have an international event, so we're good to go. People are using the chat box now.
And when you comment, do say where you're calling in from or where you're watching from as well. It's really good to know, because this is universal, right? There isn't a region, an industry, an area that the skills of thriving at work or in business do not apply. So really, really great to have you guys on. From wherever you are, even if you're local to me here in Finchley, or you're far abroad like the Republic, and I know there'll be some from Nigeria as well. So look, guys, listen, let's get into it. And actually, I wanted to come to you first, Richard, because one of the things I think that we really first have to tackle almost before we think about how do you succeed in certain skills, like, you know, communication skills or you know, rising in career development, as Simon covers, is resilience, right? Because this is a pressured time. This is a really pressured time. You know, a lot of people have been either on furlough or business has either closed down or slowed down. They've been at home, stuck with the kids, you know, which is its own special kind of privilege. I think we underestimate how stressful that can be and how that can impact on how you then perform at work or how you then approach your career development or career building. So can you just speak to stress, right? What is its impact? And then give us a few thoughts on, well, okay, how do you begin to challenge it so that you put yourself into a mental framework that means you're ready to succeed?
Yeah, for me, this is where it's really at. And obviously this is why I do the work. I suppose just to expand slightly on what I said in the initial bit there is to say that I've been studying what helps people be at their best for years and years now, and psychology has been that passion. One of those things that we're looking into, and you've mentioned the word passion, is, and people see it banded around, is, you know, this grit and resilience is the sort of is tapping into those passions, and if we can find those passions, and I can talk to about that in more detail, because there is a process that you can do to really look at that. But passion and perseverance in those areas are really where it's at. And so I've been studying psychology, neuroscience, performance coaching for numbers of years. I've studied with one of the sort of eminent performance psychologists in the US there, really, again, driving at how people operate and get at their best when the pressure's on in those stressful moments. And so I think what the first thing I'd like to say is about the attitudinal foundation that people bring to everything that they do. And so a lot of the things that I see are counterintuitive in terms of how we approach things. Now, like Simon, I'm a martial artist, and we train and we have trained together. And I'm sure Simon.
Yeah, I'm gonna want to know, by the way, who beats who in that. I'm assuming you
Richie is usually the victor.
Locking horns. It's like, you know. the reason that I mention it is to use the analogies of the martial arts, and often it's, as Simon would know, it's the novice fighter, and we do in particular a sort of grappling type of martial art a lot, and you know that they're going to grip on tight. They're going to be taken to a certain way. The intuitive thing that people do is to respond and grip on or force. And so that way of being, once you get trained in the martial art, is to then sort of say, well, you realize that doesn't work. One, it depletes your energy levels, but also it makes you so rigid, so tense, so mentally and physically tense, that it becomes ineffective action. And so what we really love when you master the art is to be able to use that against people. And so with a novice, and I'll relate this to work in a moment, but with a novice is they grip on, and you know that, and then you can sort of, well, we were sort of like slide past that, and it makes it all the more easy. Now, I think most people that I see and work with are stuck in huge amounts of stress. And this is, for me, pre-lockdown. This isn't just a COVID lockdown issue. Most people, I'm thinking of a guy I know in particular who's an executive at PepsiCo worldwide, and he, you know, he's mentioned people in the teams struggling with sleep, struggling to maintain these levels of optimum output because the stress becomes chronic. It becomes something that is a pervasive feel of stress that people have in their lives. And so the phrase that I use with people is about a mentality, a sort of square peg round hole mentality, like the novice fighter, of gripping on, of trying to force to keep our head above water. And so the way of saying that is that we've come to recognize or to be shown to that we need to do more to be more. So we need to be doing more constantly to be more. And this mentality and this approach is, from my perspective, fundamentally broken. And so the work that I look at is really about being more. It's being more present, being in the present moment more often, and I'll talk about that throughout, is to be able to recognize some of the stresses and pressures that are sometimes external, but how many of them are driven from the internal, from the perception we're making of things, of the situation we're in. And recognizing that is crucial. And so being more allows people to be more effective, allows people to reduce the stress and pressure and anxiety. So in relation to the job and life, they can think more clearly, they can be more effective, they can connect with people better, be less reactive, and they're coming from a different space. And this is, for me, really what the work is, to firstly get people to see that a little bit through some creation of self-awareness, but ultimately so they can impact their careers to be more effective. And so the last thing I'd say on that is some people had I suppose I was going to call it a wake-up call, but really to look at the start of lockdown, the report that I had from a lot of people was because they'd gone away from this tense way of doing things and they'd kind of, mentally and physically stepped back a little bit, they were reporting that they were more effective, that they were getting more done. And so many people were saying, it's the most I've done in years. And so for me, it was just an indication to show that if we tap into those right states, and I'll talk about flow states later maybe and things like that, but then that can really be a game changer.
What you've said, Richie, I think you talked a bit about self-awareness, you talked about mindfulness being in the moment. And I think when it comes to the job market, you know, we all walk around with these filters on. That's how we make our decisions. We have inherent beliefs. We don't necessarily know what those beliefs are. They're created, you know, from an early age. We carry them through life and they either help us or hurt us. But I think if you watch the news now and you look into the job market, the reinforcement is around these negative beliefs. There's no jobs. The economy's in a right mess. Yeah. What's the point? What's the point? What's the point? Now, the majority are going to think like that. But if you're the person that doesn't think like that, it presents you with a tremendous opportunity. You talked about the lockdown period. You know, there could be people sat at home who are thinking, I'm maybe not going to have a job to go back to. Well, this is maybe an opportunity to think about, well, what else could I do? Where could I reposition? Could I start my own business? So I think one of the things that I get people to do very early on in my coaching is to get them to keep a diary. I call it a thinking journal. And what we do, they keep this diary. It's a record of the actions that they take, but more importantly, what those actions mean to them. And we review it together. And it's amazing some of the hang-ups, some of the beliefs people have that they can't do this, they can't do that, which have no true basis in reality that hold them back. And once you get past that and you show them that there is an opportunity to do something different, it's just negative beliefs holding them back, it opens up a whole new world of opportunity.
You know, it's interesting, actually, you say about the keeping the journal thing, because I actually do that with my clients. Where I get them to, so I one of the things that I always emphasize to people when they're working with me, or actually really, to be honest, any coach, is very often we define success as the moment we achieve the ultimate goal that we set, right? And because that becomes our definition of success. So with my clients, it's, I want to become, you know, far better at communicating. I want to be able to give and nail that presentation or whatever it is. Because that's the definition of success, we only celebrate when we've finally achieved that goal. And I say to my clients, no, listen, in fact, when with my clients, I say, listen, we have a mantra, celebrate the journey, celebrate the journey. So all the little wins that you have along the path towards your eventual success, celebrate those with as much happiness and vigor as you celebrate the eventual journey. Because that way, instead of having one big win months later, you could have like 50 every, you know, for yeah, every day, yeah, you've got a different win. So, and I get them to keep that journal with, to kind of keep that in mind. Tell me actually, Simon, on this. Yes. So, because Richard's really given us a good kind of exploration of stress, the impact of it, and also that it's very much about the mentality you take to mm-hmm. withstand that. And that actually very relevant even to public speaking, for instance, where a lot of people are fearful about public speaking. So a big part yes. of the work I have to do is getting them to look at it in a different way. And I'll kind of talk a little bit about that. But once you start, you know, saying, okay, right, I understand I've got to manage my stress, when people start thinking about, first of all, getting a job or getting a new job, which just unfortunately may be what people are faced with right now, you talk about the hidden job market. And I remember when I interviewed on my podcast, it was a revelation. It's like, what? You know, where has this been? And why
it's hidden. I don't know where it is.
Yeah, right, right. So, yeah. So kind of if you've at least put yourself into the, I'm going to work through the stress and kind of open my eyes to what's out there. Mm-hmm. Tell us about this hidden job market thing. What is it and sure. how do you access it?
Sure. So what I realized through my recruitment days as a professional recruiter is that, you know, I went out to employers. My job was to get jobs on to then put those jobs in front of my candidates, place candidates and make fees. But employers don't always go to recruiters and don't always advertise jobs straight away. What employers tend to do is they have conversations. I call these conversations closer to home. And, you know, it's a bit like in the real world. If you need a plumber, what do? You don't go straight to the I was showing my age there, Yellow Pages or the internet now. You don't go straight to the internet. You ask people you know for recommendations. And it's the same in the job market. So when an employer is looking to hire, they tend to talk to their peer group and say, who do you know, who do you recommend that I can talk to? And they do that for two reasons. Do that for a few more reasons, actually. It's quicker. They're more likely to have to meet less people. But the most important thing, it comes with an implicit recommendation. And we're in a world now where people don't trust one another like we used to, which is very sad. It's a shame, but that's the world we live in. So that implicit recommendation is even more important, because what I found in the job market with employers when I was recruiting is often they would prefer not to hire than potentially risk making the wrong hiring decision. So the implicit recommendation, so the hidden market is the place that exists before opportunities get to recruiters or get on job boards. So what that means from a candidate's perspective is you flip things on its head. Rather than reacting to opportunities that are out there and visible for you to see, if you know who you are and what you want, and you have a unique value proposition that you believe is relevant to a certain type of employer, and you have to be niche, what is to stop you being proactive in approaching those employers? Because those employers might want to have a conversation with you now that could lead to an opportunity now, next week, or even 6 months down the line. But if you position yourself in the hidden market to do that, you're only ever in competition with yourself. Colin, we just had a quick question came through.
It was more of a
comment, and it's probably pitched at you, I think, because I think it relates to communication. Anthony popped in the group and he said, I know he's working from home at the moment. He said he's working from home and his productivity is increased. He's done more work in less time, but his bosses are blinkered and want everyone in the office. Now, that could be something to do with communication, an old fashioned way of thinking. Guys, what do you think? What can we say on that?
You know, that's an interesting, because one of the things that people actually ask me a lot actually is virtual communication, which obviously everyone's had to do during this period, and probably going forward, there's going to be a lot more in terms of virtual communication. And I think the temptation with virtual communication is to treat it as different to your kind of physical and everyday interactions. So, you know, and, you know, we do it. I mean, even I've done it, right? You make sure that your background is like, you know, pitch perfect, even though, you know, to the side I've got washing, you know, things like that. You know, or you go even worse. Yeah, right. You know,
got my shorts on.
You know, or you go even further with the virtual backgrounds, which actually drive me nuts. because, you know, aside from the fact that very often they don't work very well, you can kind of see the shadow that follows your head when you move it. You know, it's like, okay, I know you're at home, so why do you have a background of the beach, right? You know, and I think what it's done is it's tempted people to try to only present a certain kind of facade, which then undermines the kind of reality and the connection that you need to make when you're communicating with each other. So really what I kind of emphasize with people is, and again, it's kind of putting yourself into that mind frame, is think about actually, if you were meeting, you know, at the water cooler or whatever it is, what actually would you talk about and how would you speak at that moment, and engage in the same thing online? I think the temptation to be perfect, you know, have the perfect screen, have, you know, whatever, is far too strong. But it actually leads to less effective communication. So yeah. I kind of really push people on that. And that probably is where the instinct of a boss to say, no, I want everybody back in the office because, you know, things aren't the same with virtual, kind of comes from. So if you treat it as much as possible, have the same kind of chats that you would if you were in person, then it starts to feel less like a virtual space and more like an alternative space. Yeah. That you just congregate in as well.
Would you see any comments on that?
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the sort of realities of the situation that people face in terms of their work. And I think the first thing to say is that if you're in a role and a job and it's demanded upon that you have to go in and work in the office down the line, and that's what it is, then I suppose to some extent we have to go and do that. But in people that I sometimes coach is that I find sometimes, we were saying coaching that the issue is never the issue. And you find that people are skirting around somewhere else. And then what it really comes down to sometimes is they need to have a conversation, but they're really actually avoiding that conversation because it's challenging. Or they see it in a way that's, the perception they're making of that conversation might be that it's, you know, I'm challenging the boss, and it induces the stress response. It makes them, and then they just want to avoid it. And so sometimes I think about setting mental clarity can really affect our overall well-being. And sometimes it's about setting boundaries as to what we're actually going to do. And quite often it's about being challenging, you know, so with a way of maybe approaching a boss, having that conversation, but then maybe getting some clarity about what it is that conversation would look like. What would I want to be taken away? What would be something that would, you know, be suitable for me within my role? And then, so that's within our control. And then ultimately, the thing that might be out of our control is that the organization is going to say, you know, flat down, no, everybody has to be in the office. And if that's the case, then really, then you're down a road for me of asking questions about, is this role what I really want to do? Is it the way I want to work? And that's challenging because people want to stay with certainty. But that's really what I would think. It's about some elements of challenge.
I think there's been a supplementary comment coming from Anthony, and what he said is that it's not really the medium of communication that's the issue. It's actually the trust element, that the bosses don't believe people are necessarily working, which comes back to your point of, you know, you proactively try and influence your environment. If you can't influence your environment, you've got to question whether you want to be in that environment any longer. Hence you need to be on this webinar and learn how to win at work. There we go.
On that point was, I was actually on a webinar last week as well with some people, and they were describing, this is all new, isn't it? And they were describing exactly the same thing. And the girl was quite funny. She sort of said, if I don't answer an email within a minute, then her thought was that the boss, everyone thinks that she's binge watching Netflix or something. So, People were feeling that sort of pressure around those sort of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing I was saying about treat it as close as possible to how you would be at work. So, for instance, at work, right, you will knock on someone's door and ask them a small question like, oh, by the way, how do I access this document here? Or, hey, I just wrote this plan. Can you just look at this section or this paragraph, how you find it, right? And very often when we're working virtually, because it feels disconnected, we don't have those discussions and those chats and that kind of organic communication as much. So especially if you have a boss that really is suspicious about are people doing the work or not, which, you know, we'll talk about leadership actually, and I want to come to you, Simon, on leadership and things like that, but and in fact you, Richard, as well. But one of the ways you can effectively manage that is just to maintain that casual dialogue. So there's something you're working on that probably you would quickly ask your boss this small thing. Get on WhatsApp and send a quick message. Hey, what's the best phrase we can use for this letter to the client or whatever it is, right? Those organic chats that you would have when you bump into each other on the corridor, when you're on the coffee break, just maintain those. And what it means is that people feel continually connected. And then that way, it's much more difficult to question whether somebody is actually doing the work, because you are getting that continual feedback, a continual communication, not on massive things where we wait until the big work has been done, then we present it, but all the small things in between that are actually kind of it's almost like the stuff of life, right, is in those little moments. So that's kind of what I'd encourage, if that's more where Anthony's question came from.
I just need to acknowledge Adriana as well, who we're hitting a common theme and a common feeling amongst people. Just a statement come in to say that this really resonates, this kind of lack of trust. I think people are going to have to, you know, management leaders are going to have to move in this direction anyway, because I think the world has changed. So, you know, the early adopters in business will win out at the end of the day. And if you're not in the right environment, maybe you have to think about changing that environment.
Yeah, but well, also, I mean, let's look at that. Sorry, Richard, let me just let's look at that, because I want to, before we talk to people about changing environment, because I know a lot of people will be thinking, hey, listen, right now I'm just happy to have a job, right? Well, so sure. I'm not going to be rocking the boat. So let's think firstly about how to make yourself indispensable, right? So, you know, one of the things that I've seen in my work as a lawyer in employment law is that although employers will say that, you know, we have a redundancy situation, we're going to do it fairly, we're going to identify the criteria, and then whoever falls into that, unfortunately, that's who's got to leave. The reality actually very much is whether they do it consciously, which they often do, or subconsciously, what employers may do is they make a calculation in their minds as to who is indispensable. Who do we need in order to continue to work and to succeed, you know, in our business? And then they tailor things around that idea. And then whoever ends up staying is actually the people or the person that they kind of in their minds before they started the process wanted. Yeah. So that means we've really got to figure out, how do we make ourselves indispensable? How do we become or present ourselves as the employee or the manager, the leader, whatever it is, that whatever goes on with the business, you have to be retained so that, you know, you because you can show, you can demonstrate the value you have to the business. So I wanted to kind of come to you, Richard, because I know that one of the things that you talk about is getting into the ideal, I think it's, you call it the ideal performance state, and also positivity as well, because very often people who can access that state perform better and therefore are seen as more indispensable than those that kind of don't really nail it all the time. So can you just explain what you mean by the ideal performance state and also how that relates to positivity as well?
Yeah, totally. Just sort of backtracking just ever so slightly was just to say that on the trust issue as well, And the people that are working from home, one of the things that we need to be aware of in terms of self-awareness is, and this relates to what we're now going to say, but what are we saying to ourselves? So what story are we actually saying to ourselves about this situation? And often there's a perceived storyline that's sort of chirping away. We've all got the inner critic. We've all got the left brain activity of this constant narrative as to what's taking place. And we've all been guilty in the past of making our sense of something. You know, he thinks this about me, she thinks that about me, da da da, all these things, when ultimately it's not true. And sometimes, again, going back to what I said before, it's about having those conversations to be able to sort of clear those things up. The ideal performance state thing relates to that, because ultimately to be at our best is to be able to sort of access the right energy level, as I talk about it, is the right energy level which allows us to be our best. Now think about that in, if you had sort of like four quadrants of energy. And so I think this hopefully explains it, but we're looking from positive to negative, internal to external. And so in one corner there would be low negative energy. And in sporting terms, this is called tanking. This is where people give up.
I've experienced that a few times when I try to play golf.
Yeah. So it's sort of, it's tanking, you know, but we're in that, and that energy is a low negative energy. If we've got a high negative energy in the sort of top quadrant there, high negative energy, this is where we look at this stress, we're building into this. And now we're looking at states of panic, states of overwhelm, things that make us reactive. And so relating that to the workplace is, we've all had work colleagues that are overly reactive, over negative. And again, that's we're just adding to what can be a toxic team environment. And ultimately, if we're that sort of person, then people naturally don't want to work with us, and we're not naturally performing at our best. And so to finish the quadrants off, the low positive is when we're relaxed, we're mellow, and there's a time for that. And then the sort of high positive. And so we look at the ideal performance state is we don't want to overcook things in like if we're going for an interview, for example, and we need to perform at that moment. If we've got high negative energy, that's really taking us away from being able to access our best. And just to sort of finish, sort of round that up really in terms of the ideal performance state, the analogy really is around hardware and software. And so the hardware is the physiology of the body itself, but the software is really our talents and skills, and also our knowledge and abilities. So our talents, skills, knowledge and abilities. And so if we haven't got the right energy level, then it shuts us off to being able to access these software bits, our knowledge, our skills and expertise. And so that's really where the energy regulation of that and being aware of that is crucial. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it very much does, especially, you're right, there is that thing of being around someone who just drags others down with negative energy. I had never thought about that kind of high negative and low negative, but that makes perfect sense, versus being around people who have that sense of how can we achieve, how can we solve the problem, that positive energy, whether relaxed or kind of high, which I assume is energetic, really does make sense. You touched on something in terms of performing in interviews, and I definitely want to come to Simon on that, because I know you do a lot of stuff on how to speak and communicate in interviews. I'll also talk a little bit about that as well. In fact, I was telling you the other day that a friend of mine listened to the podcast that you and I had together. I think actually used some of the tips that you talked about in terms of, I think it was about framing, controlling the interview from the start.
Higher baseline.
Some of the, And use some of that. And actually, I think got a job offer, he feels, directly as a result of how he performed in the interview. So give us that when it's, because it might be an interview to get a new job. It might be an interview under redundancy situations, might be an interview for getting a promotion or pay rise. So just tell us your approach as to how you can kind of almost control the interview so that you put it in the field that works best for you. Because I know you've got some great thoughts on that.
Yeah, okay. So when people go into the interview environment, I mean, it's one of the most stressful environments that people perceive to be out there. The reality is it's a conversation. And I always get people to reframe the interview as less about an interrogation and it's more about a meeting. So if you go into an interview and you believe the spotlight's going to be on you, you're going to be asked difficult questions that you can't answer, then you're in that probably high negative state, Richie, that you talk about. You're not going to be able to perform. You're going to panic. It's going to go badly wrong. If you go into the interview prepared, but more than just prepared, with the mindset that you are going to take control of that interview, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment, you put yourself in a higher position of confidence, a calm level of confidence that will allow you to perform properly, to get into that flow state. So if you think about what happens at an interview, you know, the perception is that the interviewers will ask you questions, you will respond to those questions. Whatever they ask you, you will respond to, and you better do a good job of doing it. The reality is it doesn't need to be like that. Employers, in my experience, and I put a lot of people through interviews, they're not prepared for the interview. So the only preparation that an employer will do, and this, the more senior you get in the job market, the worse it is they'll have a quick look at the CV on the way to the interview room. That's it. And if you think about any level, but more at the senior level, the higher up you go, the person doing the interviewing doesn't interview that often, particularly when you get to second stage. So the CEO or the MD of an organization maybe interview once every 2 years, depending on the size of that organization. So they're nervous. So your job, if you know that and you think you're nervous, well, and you know that they're nervous, your job is to put them at ease. The other thing that happens at an interview, and I may get some nods here, or virtual nods, is you go into the interview and the employer, the interviewers, they talk at you for the first half an hour of an hour interview. And I used to get feedback from candidates saying, well, yeah, they just talked to me for half an hour. And I said, well, that's your fault. You know, they're talking at you because they're nervous. They're trying to fill that gap, that space that we all fear in new conversations. You know, you go on a date or back in the day, you went on a date and there was that awkward silence. You don't want that. So that's one of the reasons employers talk. So if you go into the interview and you start the conversation from what I call this higher baseline from the off, you immediately position yourself head and shoulders above the other candidates. And what the higher baseline is, when you go in, you're not talking about the weather. You're not talking about the journey in. What you're talking about is something that you have understood from your research and you're already positioning your higher level of knowledge. So for example, if I was going on an interview and I was establishing a higher baseline, what I would say at the start of the interview is, hey, thank you very much. It's great to be here. Great to have the opportunity to meet you in person. Just before we get going, I wanted to let you know I've done this, this, and this to prepare for this interview. And one of the things that I uncovered was this, which I hope we have an opportunity to talk about. What the employer then knows is, wow, this candidate's prepared. You as the candidate have told the employer not everything you know, because otherwise you're the one talking, but you're telling them what you've already done. So they know they don't need to tell you everything. You create space in that interview for a conversation and it becomes more of a conversation than an interrogation. That's kind of it at a very, very high level. And then there's various strategies that you would use in the interview. The ultimate aim in the interview, and if you think about when you're in an interview, if you're there in the interview room, the employer knows you can do the job. Otherwise, you wouldn't be there. It's evident from your skills and experience. Their decision making is ultimately based on one thing and one thing alone. And that is their gut feel about you at the end of that interview. What influences our gut feel? All the things we're not really cognizant of, all the soft skills. So if you create a conversation, you allow the employer to feel calmer in your company and the conversation flows because you're controlling that conversation. When it gets to the end, they're more likely to push you through to the second round or offer you the job. And I know this to be true because I've been put candidates through interviews for many, many, many years. What I would ask the employer at the end of the interview, why this candidate over that candidate? 90% of the time, the employer could never give me a reason. They didn't say it's because of this skill or that experience. What they usually said was, not quite sure. There was just something about that person. And that's what the higher baseline influencing the gut feel is really all about.
Can I just say, Simon, that when we talked about this, it was literally a revelation. It was like scales falling off my eyes, because I just thought that is genius. It's because very often I think people going into that scenario, right, whether it's you're interviewing for a new job or trying to negotiate a pay rise, or it's a redundancy consultation and you kind of you're trying to save your job, yeah, you assume that you are at a power imbalance. And that puts you into the stress state that Richard talked about. And it also means that you don't look at the opportunity to frame the entire conversation in a way that works for you. And that has a negative impact on how you perform. Then you're kind of almost leaving it up to chance as to, well, did I say things in a way that they were wanting to hear in their minds? But as you say, yeah, if they're not particularly prepared anyway, which is very much the case, even on redundancy consultations, for instance, that I deal with, very often people aren't prepared. And therefore, if you can take control of that conversation, it really does make a difference. I love that whole approach. It actually fits very much with what I talk about when I discuss what I say are communication super skills. And in fact, just to give a little scenario, actually, which shows how this works in all examples. Many years ago in my chambers, as a barrister, I'm part of the management committee. We had two senior employees and we had to make one redundant. And when I look back at it, actually, we had a brief chat before the consultation meetings. We weren't hugely prepared. We had some questions, but they weren't deeply thought out. Mm-hmm. One of our employees came in and just sat down and said, okay. And then we started asking questions and his responses were okay, average, some good, some better than others. But he just was reactive and just responded to what we decided we were going to talk about. And he finished and we were all distinctly unimpressed. The next employee came in and he had notes of, this is all the work that I've done that has brought in work into chambers. This is, hey, and he did, I don't know whether he knew you or something, but he did almost what you said, which is he came in, was already prepared and started talking about the work, the business development that he had brought to our chambers. And the entire discussion turned into a discussion about, oh yes, that's right, you did do that with this. How have you followed up on that? And he had answers to that.
And you can actually,
it was a no-brainer. Yeah. Just from the way, the confidence with which he controlled and framed the discussion so that he just left us in with an easy decision to make.
You take that a step further as well. I call this the 90-day plan. So if you go to the interview, then you can go and you can react to questions and you can talk about what you have done. But even more important is to talk about, particularly when you're going for a new job, because people haven't got experience of what you've done, only what's on your CV. If you can talk more about what you can proactively do for the organization you're interviewing with and talk about actual value that you could bring and things that you would do in the first 90 days of employment, there's a real shift there because the employer, the interviewers then see you not as somebody applying for the job, but as somebody already in the job. And you're having a discussion not about what you've done, but about what you would do for them, which really moves the conversation in a way that increases the probability, because that's what the job market's all about, probability of you being the one that progresses or offered the job.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Sorry, Richard, you look like you're about to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm looking at this from the psychology perspective as well. But there's a few things sort of jumping out, really. And one of those things that we really mentioned is about control. And so ultimately, I suppose what Simon's saying is, If I'm going in there waiting for this interrogation, this barrage of questions that are out of my control, then naturally that induces this stress response. And so, I mean, the first thing to say also, though, is going into an interview is, I've talked about those energy levels, is recognizing that our energy level is going to be up, or hopefully it's going to be up, for us to be able to access our best. And so if we're not switched on and we're not into, you know, we haven't switched on, then that's not going to help us. And so I think often people kind of get this jittery feeling of like, I'm going into something now, you know, and they start to associate that with fear. And really it's the body's natural response for sort of switching us on to be able to do something, you know. And you know, even just sat here talking on this is like, you know, it's not totally like you just sat having a cup of tea. Well, we know having a cup of tea is something there, but it's relaxing. But at the same time, you know, there's a switching on element as well. And so that right energy level, that's going to be taking place. The other thing I was going to say as well also is really to be able to perform in any arena, be it sporting, business, whatever context, particularly when under pressure, is our ability to focus. And so that driving that focus, and if you imagine that interview scenario we're talking about there, and it's all sort of coming in, we can have this, it's called metacognition, but we can have this narrative playing out in the head as, oh God, I've messed that bit up, and they think that about me and all the rest of it. And all those things are distracting and taking away from focus. And the net result of that often is that the person just doesn't seem connected. And again, going back to the subconscious thing that we pick up on people is something about them, they just weren't kind of there. They didn't appear confident. Whereas on the flip side of that is when we're engaging, we're kind of on the front foot a little bit. We're in some sort of element of control, and we're actually focusing in on what it is that we're wanting to do.
Yeah, guys, we've got a question.
Great minds. I was just about to say that I know you get the questions to you, but yes. It felt like this was a good moment to take a question from the people. And of course, if you've just joined us, which some people have, please just type in a question that you have. Tell us who you are, you know, who you are, where you're from. But type in a question that you have, and we're gonna have more of a Q&A at the end as well, anyway. But we kind of want to take some questions as we go through, because it makes it more kind of interactive, more organic. So yeah, give us the question, Simon.
Yeah, I think this is probably, I'll probably come to you on this this one first, Colin. And Andy has popped this question in and drawn quite an interesting parallel between some of the stuff you do about presentation skills, which you've already mentioned, and the interview environment. And has asked probably something we've all done: how can he reduce the sweating and shaking he feels whenever he walks into the interview environment or indeed does a presentation? Any thoughts on that?
Oh yes, I mean, this is so, how long have you got? Because I love this subject. I'm kind of obsessed with it, but in particular it is the thing that concerns people the most. And part of it is related to what we call imposter syndrome. So imposter syndrome is that feeling that, do I deserve to be here? Am I going to be found out? You know, I had that as a barrister, where you kind of, one day you're a student, the next day you're a barrister with clients, and you're thinking, do they realize that I don't really know what I'm doing? Right? You know, especially in the early days. And what that induces is those stress factors. And just to explain how it works physiologically, right? So especially when you're giving a presentation or you're at a Q&A, and someone asks you a question to which you don't know the answer, right? Which can happen in interviews, it can happen at the end of a presentation or in the middle, so forth. So what happens is that triggers in us the adrenaline that flows when you feel under pressure or under stress or under threat, right? So back in kind of, you know, caveman days, it was the way your body says fight or flight, right? You've got to be ready to fight because you're, you know, about to be attacked by a saber-toothed tiger. Right. Or you better be ready to run because you ain't going to defeat that dinosaur, whatever it is. Right. Now, the problem with that is that was what our bodies needed then. But now we're not fighting saber-toothed tigers. We're not running away from lions and whatever it is. We are still standing there in the middle of the stage having to answer a question. So the adrenaline flows through our bodies and that has to go somewhere. And usually it then goes in the form of the different symptoms that people feel when they're under stress: shaky hands, you know, knocking feet. Mine actually is sweat, just kind of like, you know, you can feel, you can feel it just, yeah, you can feel the beads start here, and I'm like, oh gosh, okay, right. And then it starts running, and then I know that if it gets down to about here, then it's all over, because then others are going to be, oh, we're sweating now, and everything just comes, right? Especially with a bald, shiny head kind of thing. And so because the adrenaline has nowhere to go, it manifests itself in that way. And then you become stressed, you then lose it, and then you panic, and the kind of high negative energy state, all of that. So there are a few ways that I advise when I'm talking about communication. One of the most important things to understand, and it's a really difficult one for people to get their head around, is this, is that when people ask you a question, what they want from you is not actually the answer, right? So that might sound counterintuitive, but it's this. So although, yes, they've asked a question like, you know, what is 1 + 1? You know, is it 2? Whatever, right? It looks like or feels like they've asked me a question. I need to give the answer. But when you are in interview scenarios, when you're answering questions in a meeting or on stage or whatever, invariably what the person actually wants is confidence in you. That's the thing they're looking at for most. So for an example, when I was a young barrister, I used to be focused on answering every question as detailed as possible. And all that happened is they would ask me more questions. Well, what about this? And what happens is they say this in the evidence and so forth. And I'd answer that and they just come back with more. And then I actually had a case where I was working with a senior barrister, and he actually came late to the meeting. It's like, yeah, great. So I was being peppered with questions by the clients, like the client, big CEO corporates. And they would just ask me question after question. And I'm, sweating, right? Then the senior barrister waltzes in, just speaks with command and authority, and then says, any questions? And I'm thinking, right, yeah, they're going to give it to you now. And I still remember, it's the only question the CEO of the company had was, oh, okay, so what time should we meet in court? And I'm sitting there saying, what? Like, you just peppered me for the last 30 minutes with every question under the sun, which I know I didn't answer very well. And this guy strolls in, you ask him nothing. Why? Mm. Because they had confidence in him. Mm. So the reason that's relevant is, so for instance, when you're asked a question to which you don't know the answer, for instance, if your focus is on, in order to be successful, I need to know the answer, you will get stressed, you will shake, you'll start to panic. If you recognize that all you need is to make sure the person has confidence in you, you realize it doesn't matter if you don't know the answer, but if you can facilitate the answer coming out, then that is just as impactful for the person who's asked the question. So classic thing I would say to people is, when you're asked a question, you don't know the answer, turn into a facilitator, right? Is, I don't know the answer to that actually, but that's a really great question. Kind of some of the things I would think about, and you talk about around the subject, what do you think about that? Especially if there are other people, and you engage in a discussion. And what happens is that when the eventual solution or answer comes out as part of that discussion, people still give you the benefit of having given the answer. So, wow. You know, like when you retweet something or repost something on LinkedIn, right? Somebody else created the content, but you get likes on your feed. You get comments on your saying, oh, Richard, thanks for sharing that. That's a great message. You know, Simon, I love this. And you're thinking, mate, I didn't do it, right? People associate you with having provided the information, even if it didn't actually come from you. Wow. Or it allows you to say, I'll come back to you, but not just I'll come back to you. This is a little trick I'll kind of leave with, is don't just say I'll come back to you, because everyone kind of knows that, oh yeah, that's what to do when you don't know the answer. Oh, I'll come back to you. Say, you know what? That's a good question. I actually don't know that. I'll come back to you by Wednesday morning. Yeah. Put a date on it. Because what that says is you're not floundering. You're not just trying to escape. You have no idea. You're in control. You're comfortable with the fact that you don't know the answer. But you are making a commitment that you're going to come back to them by a specific date, which sounds much more concrete. And what does that do? It gives them confidence in you. And then they won't question it. Nobody's going to say, no, you must come back to me now. They say, oh, okay, yeah, sure, I'll look out for it. And then you work your butt off to go and find the answer and send it to them even earlier than you committed to, and engage in a dialogue at that stage. So, yeah, stress, shaking, all of that. It's a physiological response. there are things you can do to put yourself in the right zone. Obviously, be prepared and things like that. But in the moment, don't focus on what is the direct answer to the question. Focus on how do I get these people to believe in me, to have confidence in me, whether I actually know the answer or not. And it's just a different ballgame.
It's great. It's great. There's been a supplementary kind of question that's come on for you, Richie, in relation to this, because you talk, Colour, about the fight or flight. Obviously, in the special forces world, Richie, you're there to fight. I guess there's no option to flight, and it is potentially a life or death. It's a potentially a life or death situation. So, any lessons from the military on that? Because you really are in that. You got to fight. That's it.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, and you're surrounded by highly trained guys as well. And again, it's about those sort of control things. Sometimes term it, mission thinking or neutral thinking, to be with the realities of what's going on. I.e., you're into a contact and you've got a casualty. It's basically, what are you going to do from that point onwards? Now, in the sort of smaller teams that we in particular worked in, I suppose in some ways it was flight, was the, for our training really was, there's, you come under contact, you're in a four-man team, literally we'd sort of fan out and put a wall of fire down, to get graphic on this, a wall of fire down, which would be like that immediate punch back, if you like, but then it would be breaking contact, and so it would be then getting away from the situation so that we could break contact, get to somewhere where we could reorg and see that casualties and ammunition checks and things like that, and then break out to somewhere to try and get to that safer space. I mean just one thing to add as well on the stress response, really, is, I suppose, autonomic arousal, as it's called, is really to look at the fact that there's two aspects really to that, which is a sympathetic nervous response, technical term, but is basically the fight or flight response. And the opposite of that being parasympathetic nervous. And both of those are available to us as humans. And so this is about the physiology of the body. And so sometimes we can basically tap into, particularly when we've got heightened states of emotion, it's coming from the thoughts or the situation, is to really ground ourselves in the present. And I like to use a phrase which sort of says, aware of the past, grounded in the present, and in control of the next behavior. And that really is where we would look at things. It's really being aware of the past and what's taken place, grounded in the present, which is ultimately where high performance happens, whether that be in an interview, whether that be in a presentation, whether that be in special forces contact, whatever it may be, but then in control of the next behavior, really. So,
guys, I just want to kind of remind everyone, because there's so much that we've touched on, which I love. And by the way, Richard, I love technical speak, by the way, so that's just me. I love it when there are terms for everything. But I just wanted to encourage everyone that once this webinar or this panel is finished, so we'll go for about another half an hour, from 2 p.m., which will be kind of an hour and a half after that, we will release on the page that you registered on, and then kind of, so winatworkwebinar.com/agenda, that will be the page where you'll be able to access a recording of this particular webinar, but also all of our individual workshops. So I know, Simon, you've got something in more detail on the hidden job market.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Yes.
And Rich, you've got some more detail on performing under pressure, because I know people will be hearing lots of different things from us. And I think it's important that you really will be able to go and access that. It's going to be up for a long time. So do go and access it. Take the individual workshops. Reach out to either myself on communication skills, Simon on career development, Richard on Performing Under Pressure, or all three of us at once, if you're really kind of trying to take yourself to the next level.
I've just shared those. I've just shared that link, Collar, in the chat box. I'll also share our individual links as well.
Fantastic. So guys, let's take for this last half hour, and if there are any questions that you think relevant to this as well, Simon, please pitch them in. I wanted to look at leadership, right? Because in all of our different ways, we are very focused on leadership. From my work of communication, I'm looking at the kind of the high level of what does it take to be a great communicator so that you can be an outstanding leader. And similarly, Richard, I imagine that especially from your military training and background, that leadership is crucially important. Because when you're faced with pressure, whether that's fire or work or whatever, you want people who are able to stand and say, right, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, and get other people on board. And likewise, Simon, I imagine people in the job market or employers are looking for people that they see as leaders.
Yeah.
So what is it that makes people consider you to be a leader, whereas they look at somebody else to be, you know, not leadership material or just kind of manager, but not leader? I know there's a bit of a dichotomy there. Let me come to you first, Simon, on that. Just what is your thoughts on leadership and what it is and how to demonstrate it?
Sure. Okay. So the term leadership, I think we have to be careful with that term, because I think as soon as we talk about leadership, people's perception immediately is the leader is the person at the top of the organization, the CEO, the MD, and everybody else is the employee. And that's not actually the case. I think it was a question we had earlier. It sparked a conversation about employee and being proactive, et cetera, et cetera. I believe people can be leaders at any stage of their career. You have a responsibility to lead your own career, and in the workplace, you have a responsibility to lead a project, a particular job, or whatever else you find yourself doing. So leadership is something that we should embrace at all stages of our career, not just this thing towards the end of our career when we reach the summit of the mountain, to coin a phrase. So that's the first point. That's the first point I'd make. For me, leadership is probably about two or three things. The first thing leadership is about is leading by example. So if you're the leader in an organization, I firmly believe that in any organization, big, small, medium, it's the leader that sets the culture. It's the leader that sets the behavior. You can't have a leader telling the workforce to do one thing and then behaving in a completely different way. So if the leader wants an entrepreneurial environment, the leader has to be entrepreneurial. If the leader wants another kind of environment, they have to display those. You know, if the leader wants everyone to turn up into the office on time in the morning, they have to be the first one in. So you have to lead by example. I'm sure it's the same in the military, Richard, when we come on to you. I think the other thing that's very important in leadership is this thing called emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence has been a lot more publicized, a lot more important in recent years. You know, Richard, you talked a little bit about mindfulness earlier. It's about being in the moment. It's about the recognition of how people behave, their feelings, being in touch with your own feelings. And what I'm talking about there is not, you know, not anything, not being softly or you know, touchy-feely, but being very self-aware that as a leader, you don't have all the answers to all the questions. You sometimes don't ask the best questions to get the best answers. And although you are the leader of the organization, you have a team surrounding you that is a team that probably has better answers than you. And it's about how you get the best out of those people. So being emotionally intelligent enough and being self-aware enough to understand that, I think, is a really important characteristic of good leadership. So a couple of things there. There's a lot more I could go on, but we're limited on time, so I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. And Richard, I definitely want to hear from you, because, you know, it's one thing to look for leaders at work. You know, so often the stats are actually quite shocking about how many people leave work because of bad leadership. Right. But in the army, that ain't an option. Right. You know, unless you're going to, you know, commit, you know, go AWOL and, you know, whatever. Presumably, whatever leader you have is the leader you are faced with. So it makes it even more important to demonstrate good leadership because you rarely recognize that I assume your troops kind of have no choice, right? You know, so what is it from your point of view that is good leadership, that demonstrate good leadership?
The first thing to say, Colin, I mean, the military model, if you like, was called mission command for us, or mission leadership as it was. And the old military model was command and control, telling people what to do. And yes, in the balance of that, sometimes, the understanding amongst the guys is, that if it's a critical situation, then somebody needs to make that shout. But ultimately, it's about, going back to my last analogy, if you're breaking contact from somewhere, any one of the team could see, we're talking about people trying to save lives in this, for instance, but any one of the team could see the best way to go. And so that's about developing trust. And so trust is the glue that binds teams, as we sometimes say, and it's about building that trust. And going back to what Simon said is, this is where people can break that down with the levels of emotional intelligence by sort of stamping down on people, can really start to put people in a position where they're put into fight or flight type responses because they're scared to make a mistake or scared to do something which is not their decision, if you like. And so if leaders do things in that way, then they may get short-term compliance, but ultimately for me, the longer term ramifications of building a team starts to break down. And so we don't get that trust. And what I would say is in any environment I've come across, and I've done a lot of leadership training in the corporate world from the military as well. And really what people don't really get sometimes is they get this idea of what military leadership is. But ultimately, it's about relationships. It's still about relationships. It's about building good relationships. And we sort of say, leaders within the organization, know your men, know your people. And not just on a work basis, but it was about kind of knowing that their wife and their dog and what matters to them. And this really builds that trust. Once we get that trust, then that can have a massive impact on performance, really. And so the last thing I would sort of say to just suppose sum that up is, for me, often it's about a mentality which is leaders on all levels, as Simon was saying, anyone can be a leader. But ultimately, if people are in a sort of leadership position, is to be aware of giving control rather than controlling. That's really what empowers people.
Yeah, my favorite quote, because I love my quotes on leadership, is by Lao Tzu, who was a Chinese philosopher, kind of ancient Chinese philosopher, and also kind of military tactician. And I was just pulling it up actually as you were speaking, because what you said just reminded me of that. So it's this: it's a leader is best when people barely know he exists. When his work is done, his aim fulfilled, they will say, we did it ourselves. And I love that quote because it's about that your role as a leader primarily is to empower other leaders, is to grow other people to the point that they don't even feel that you did anything because they take ownership of it. And so that's why I love the part, they will say, we did it ourselves. And as a leader, unless you have ego to such an extent that you want to be the sun and everyone revolves around you, when you see that people feel that we did it ourselves, we created it ourselves, we achieved it ourselves, that is an indication of your success as a leader, because you have grown and empowered other people. You have made them take ownership, made them feel in control. And I always say to people, as a leader, don't try and be the sun. Because as a sun, everyone's revolving around you. And if you don't say something, it doesn't happen. What you want to be is like the moon, which is reflected glory, right? So your glory comes from the success of your team, the success that you've been able to encourage and build people on. And even from a communication skills perspective, I actually talk about the three levels of communication. And level three is kind of, you know, high elite level, really. And to give an example with listening, which is such a crucial communication skill, level one of listening is where you listen to respond. And that's what most people do. They listen so that they have what they want to say. They listen, they wait for an opening to say it, and then they say it, right? And that's level one kind of listening. That's actually what vast majority of people...
I've never done that, Colin, no.
guilty as charged.
Yeah, well, my wife would probably say, so you're at level one then, Colin, but yeah. not even, in fact, you haven't reached level one yet, Colin. Yeah, so listening to respond is where a lot of people are. They're just listening so that they can say what they want to say anyway. Level two is listening to understand. And that's where you genuinely are, okay, well, let me hear what this person has to say so that I get where they're coming from. And that is actually where most people kind of plateau out, because that's seen as, you know, the way you should listen. It's often called active listening. But what I've discovered in the work that I've done with communication is that there's a third kind of higher level in lots of different areas, but in listening, for instance, which is listening to connect, right? This is empathetic, deep empathetic listening, where you're listening so that both of you can come to a common understanding and a shared perspective, where it just feels almost symbiotic. And that is the space where people feel completely listened to. They feel great trust in you. This is the space where people start telling you things that they don't say to other people, because you've developed that strong bond, that they feel connected to you, that they feel, yes, I can share. This person really gets me. This person understands me. This person isn't just trying to say what they want to say, but they're actually trying to see it from my point of view and help both of us get to the level we want to get to. And as a leader, I think your ability to communicate so that people feel empowered is crucially, crucially important. And if you do nothing else in terms of trying to become a better leader than just practice deep listening to connect with whoever you're speaking with, that will take you masses of the way there towards becoming more empowering of your team. You know, when you get those leaders that everybody just seems to want to work for, right? Mm. People go the extra mile. They somehow believe in that leader, and that leader makes them feel good. A lot of that is that level three communication where people just feel connected to you, and just makes everything possible. I don't know if that makes sense, just from kind of putting that perspective.
It does. We've had a kind of question on that, an observation on that. Aisha's made the comment we have two ears and one mouth, so we should listen more.
Yes,
this is very true. Yes. But also asked the question about when we're in discussions with people, whether it be in the job market or in work or whatever else, people naturally disagree with us at times. And how do we get past that situation where when people disagree with us, the knee-jerk reaction can be to get into this kind of battle mode. But from what you're saying, Carla, if I hear things correctly, and this, I think this is where we're going with this question, is if people do disagree with you, how do you get the best out of that conversation?
Yeah, and it's very related to, if you try and establish connection, then it ceases being a battle. It becomes, what is the best answer to this question or this problem? And then you both become involved in it. So a good example, and you know, you'll have had this problem, most people have had this in their personal lives. You know, when you're in an argument, right? It's a back and forth and nobody's giving ground, right? It doesn't matter what you say. You'll be plotting in your mind, oh yeah, I know, once I say this though, they're gonna see that they're wrong, they're gonna fold, right? And then you say it and they just come back with their own version of what you're wrong about and fold, right? Nobody gives ground. But the minute you have somebody say, oh, you know what, I see your point on that, or I apologize, you know what, I was wrong on that thing, on that aspect, you know what, my bad, I actually hold my hands up to it, what happens? The opposition melts away. People start falling over themselves to be, oh, yeah, but actually I have to apologize for that thing I said. And yeah, you know what, when you said that thing, I didn't appreciate initially, but you're right. Actually, it suddenly becomes not a battle between each other, but a battle together. And then you become much more focused on, well, what is the answer to the issue? And you become connected in trying to solve it, rather than I say my point, you say yours, and we just butt heads. So again, that's where kind of the listening, but trying to reach a connection. Kind of when I talk about communication with people, what I say is, whether you're negotiating, whether you're presenting on stage, whether you're trying to persuade in a meeting, when you can get the frame of the discussion into a place where everyone feels on the same page on the issue, that not agreeing on it, but that they're all trying to find the answer, it just becomes self-reinforcing. So everyone is just contributing to that process of getting the best answer, rather than I want my answer to win out. And if you're the one that facilitated that, everyone just refers to you as, oh, that person's a great leader, that person's a great communicator.
You're into it's very akin to the, or aligned with the martial arts, particularly Aikido, which is all about get out of the way of.
I was just thinking.
I won't get into that. Yeah, I call it step off the track, get out of the way of the train and let it run past, and then reposition. So anyway,
To sort of bring it back full circle, is that martial arts analogy that we sort of said at the start, isn't it? This sort of forcing thing, but I think totally right, Carl. I mean, there's the one thing I would sort of say sometimes is our awareness, our self-awareness of our own ego sometimes, of having and asking ourselves the questions, you know, why am I, you know, what is it about this is that means that I've got to stamp my authority or win this conversation, if you like. Yeah,
guys, we've got a question. We've got quite a few questions, but the one I want to come to, conscious of time, is that we've a couple of people have mentioned this. I'm not going to name anybody in particular, but talking about managing workload and feeling overwhelmed by workload. How do you tackle? I think we all feel like that at times. Advice?
This sounds like a Richard one, I think.
Go on, Rich.
Well, the first thing I'd say, because I'm sort of short of time slightly, is like that everybody thinks, again, military is like, oh, precision military and so on. But it's not. I have to say, it's not always the case. Not just for myself, but with everybody else as well. So it is something that we need to be aware of and sort of work at. One of the main things that is around, sometimes, you know, when we look at this sort of stress, often it is overwhelm. And that's a lack of psychological clarity. And often recognition that psychological clarity is intricately linked to our well-being. And so, again, bringing these things down is really just starting to try and frame this to buy down on some of the uncertainty that we might feel with overwhelm, to really look at those actionable steps and to really break that down. And this really comes back to, again, the sort of being able to get back to the present moment in what I need to do. It's hugely powerful. Obviously, writing things down and breaking things down, looking at those next steps, what do I need to take action on? And the reality is when we can actually focus into a task, then we can start to alleviate the stress response. And so once we start to do that, then we start to see ourselves moving towards what an actionable goal. And on a physiological level, that really releases dopamine in the brain that gives us a good feeling of now we're taking action and can start to build that level of confidence where, you know, confidence is something that is that sort of comes and goes. It comes and goes with what we're saying to ourselves at any point, really. So my major thing with overwhelm really is about creating clarity, just linking that in with the leadership of mission leadership that I said there. Ultimately, when we looked at like a mission for ourselves, it was always getting very, very clear. In those situations, we would get clear. And the first couple of questions were, and I talk about this in the workshop a bit, but what are we being asked to do and why? And so when we can get very clear on that, then we could start to, then we can get onto the how we're actually going to break that down. But what is it that I'm actually trying to do and why? What is my purpose, the task and purpose? And so I take teams through with that. And what I would say out of interest is that, you know, really high level teams in corporate companies, often when you start to drill down on what their purpose is, what are they there to do and why, there's some blank faces going yeah. on. You know, these overall mission statements that companies have that nobody buys into, but when you break it down into parts of an organization to say, to get that clarity, often people just don't have that clarity.
I've been in too many meetings, Richie. I've been in too many meetings where the chair has said, well, so what are we here for? What are we, and you know you're in the wrong meeting then.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that as well. Actually, I do a lot of work with companies on their elevator pitch, which is just, you know, that short statement of what the company is about, right? And I will typically divide whatever group I have, I'll divide them into two, and we play kind of a little, almost like a hangman equivalent game, which is just guess what the other team says in a 20 word statement is the ethos, the mission, whatever it is of the organization. They never get it, right? They never get it. I'll divide, so CEO here, you know, MDs here, whatever, so that they're not just all the leaders in one and the employees. They never get it. They never have a shared perspective of what the mission, as you were saying, Richard, is. And that is very much down to leadership not properly articulating the vision and not properly getting everyone on board with that same vision so that everybody gets it, everybody can repeat it to others, and everyone buys into it as well.
One thing to say just for people listening in is that can be on a personal level as well. When we're talking about the overwhelm, going back to what Simon said there, is again getting that clarity for ourselves about how do I want to be in this situation? How would I be at my best in this moment, in this situation? What am I moving towards and why? You know, it's like really getting clear on that. And it takes some work. It takes a level of discipline sometimes to be aware and to do that. But if we can, then my belief is, and I suppose from why we're here, but my belief is that we can set ourselves apart from most people that just don't do that. And so, and that shows that level of confidence.
I think on the overwhelm stuff, you know, multitasking is something people have said to me for many years, and they've used that in interviews as kind of a badge of honor. And I've always thought, you know, multitasking, it's panic, it's confusing. You've got to be in one task at a time, being in the moment, as we've talked about. The other thing I talk about is process, not prize. So whatever you're doing, whatever you're trying to achieve, if you focus on the prize, very difficult to get there. If I think about what I've done in lockdown, I've written a book, 185,000 words. If I thought about the enormity of that task, I never would have done it. Yeah. One chapter a day, one step at a time, you eventually, if you don't stop and you don't quit, you get to the end of the journey. Yeah, and you've got to enjoy the journey. You've got to celebrate. Exactly. So I'm not very good at that.
Yeah. Guys, this is really kind of, I think we were in your state of flow, Richard, that you talk about, because this is really, really flowed. I've enjoyed this discussion enormously, and really kind of, it's really helped me understand a few things, especially as I was listening out with my daughter's 11 plus in one ear there, Richard. And I kind of got a lot of tips on that. So really, really great discussion, guys. As I said, as I started this webinar on, we're looking at what does it take to be indispensable in your workplace, in your business, whether it's making sure you keep your job if in these hyper competitive times it's at risk of being lost, or it's getting that promotion, or it's becoming the leader and learning how to perform under pressure, or it's being able to communicate in a way that makes people believe in you. This has been really, really enjoyable discussion, guys. It's just great to have your different perspectives on the same issues to show that there's kind of different ways of looking at it that are all related. I wanted to come to each of you just to give a final word, because I think we're now nearly 12:30, to give a final word on your kind of whether it's your mission, your view on as to what it really takes to be indispensable, the key things, and then also just quickly give us kind of a 20 seconds, 30 seconds on the workshop that people will be able to access at 2 o'clock, which is about an hour and a half. We will release them all then, as well as the recording of this webinar in case you missed it or weren't able to come to it. So just give us a little précis of what your individual workshops are about, and then I'll give mine at the end and then close. So I'll start with you, Simon, because I started with Richard earlier. So I'll come to you first.
Okay. So in terms of being indispensable, I think the overarching message I'd like to give people is don't be reactive, be proactive in everything you do. I have used a rule of thumb in life for quite a few years now. I looked at what other people do and think what I could do differently. What lengths am I prepared to go to? So putting yourself out there, stepping out of your comfort zone and staying there long enough to get comfortable with a new level of being and achieving, I think is a really useful message. In terms of my workshop, it's about 55 minutes long. I'm going to dive into a number of different areas, why the hidden job market exists, the psychology of job search success. I think there's a little bit in planning about planning on there. Kind of give you an overview as to what it takes to stand out, to get hired in the job market ahead of your competition.
Excellent. And I know that's a really good workshop just from the work that I've kind of seen of yours as well. So thank you for that, Simon. Richard.
Well, yeah, the first thing to say is that I've really enjoyed this conversation as well. And I would, for people listening in, I've enjoyed the prep work that we've done in getting this, because working with you two guys, I'm not just saying it, you know, experts in the field of what you're doing. So I'm all ears as well, some of the things I'm listening to there. The work of Man on a Mission, I'm just going to say it. I'm going to credit Simon with the name, because we did actually talk about this, and I was trying to get this thing, and he's like, you know, you mentioned mission a few times. My surname's Man, so the work of Man on a Mission really is for people. It's a real honest passion of mine to help people be at their best. Is the phrase that I would sort of use, and I think so often, despite best intentions, we're just impacted on from our inner and outer world. And so it's really about being at our best, with a sort of crazy that we can train three things as humans. And that's really, we can train our craft and the things that we do. We can train our body for some of us, and we can train our mind. And I think this third element is the thing that has been shown that you can train to build greater levels of confidence, calm, focus, trust in ourselves, optimism, grit, resilience, this psychological framework. But the good news is that we can train it. It takes work. And I think with all the things that we're saying there, for us to be at our best, there is no quick fix. There is no hack and thing to jump in on that we could just do. It takes time. It takes application on a consistent basis to keep coming back to. And I think ultimately, over time, that is the thing which really sets ourselves apart in the job market, in the things that we do, because we've got that level of confidence that we can really say. A phrase that I like to be able to say to ourselves is, I can do difficult things. And when we can say that, then we can take that into all aspects of our life. And so just briefly on the workshop, I'm covering these kind of things. I'm talking about thinking fundamentals. I'm talking about overwhelm and clarity. Some of the things that we've mentioned there, maybe slightly short, it's about half an hour, but yeah, hopefully enjoy it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that, Richard. I can attest to the differences of working your mind, body, and so forth. I've neglected the working on my body during this lockdown. Started with great intentions and didn't really get very far. So I might need to come to you on tips on how to maintain that. In terms of me, really enjoyed the discussion, as I said. And obviously, from my particular passion, I say that one of the key things for making yourself indispensable is being able to communicate effectively. As I started kind of the opening for my section saying, is that it's now not enough to be good at the job. It's now not enough to have a great product or a great service. You've got to be able to articulate it in a way that is concise and compelling and convincing to other people. And if you can't do that, whereas in the past it was kind of okay, you could get by being good at what you did. Now in this hyper-competitive world, if you can't articulate it well, people won't buy into you and believe it, and they will gravitate towards other people that can. So that's what I'm about, and that's what I see as one of the key skills for being indispensable. And my workshop is actually very much about how to develop what I call the communication super skills that will allow you to thrive. And I talk about, as I kind of alluded to in this webinar, the three levels of communication. And my work in particular is getting people to that level three, which is kind of the higher level, elite level communication, where you just are a great communicator. And that means that people gravitate towards your way of thinking, your ideas, and see you as indispensable. So that's my workshop. As I said, everyone who's been on the webinar and for all the chats and some of the questions we've been able to get to, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you guys joining us. Hope you've enjoyed the discussion and found value in it. Simon has posted the links in the chat group, so make sure you click on those before this webinar kind of closes down, so you've got it. There'll be an email as well. We'll send you an email with the links and everything, but essentially go to winatworkwebinar.com/agenda and you'll see everything. We'll release that at 2 p.m. to give you enough time to have lunch and give us enough time to kind of relax as well. All right. So listen, thank you everyone for joining us on the Win at Work webinar. I think we may do this again sometime. Really enjoyed it. Thank you, Richard.
Let's do it.
I was just thinking the same, round two, Colin, maybe.
Yeah, indeed. So, Simon, you're the man in control, so I'm going to ask you to kind of shut things down. Okay. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us.
Okay. Thanks, guys. I'll shut things down now. Thanks. Thank you. Bye-bye.